The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Pott.
And we're delighted today to be joined by Henry Jeffries. Henry is a drinks expert and award-winning author. His writing has appeared in The Guardian, The Daily Telegraph, BBC Good Food, and of course, The Spectator. He was the features editor at Spirit Specialist Master of Malt. And his latest book, The Cocktail Dictionary, is out now. Henry, thank you for joining Table Talk.
Great to be here. Yeah. I'm a fan, so it's good to be on board.
Ah.
A friend of the show. Well, it's lovely to have you with us. We're going to start where we always do, at the beginning. Can you tell us about your earliest memories of food?
I'm not sure about my very earliest, but I was very fortunate in that my mother was a good cook. In fact, she was a sort of semi-professional cook. She went to domestic science college in Aberdeen. She used to cook for the board of directors for Hodder and Stoughton Publishers when she was young. So she used to go out every day to Green Lanes. They lived in Stoke Newington and visit all the Greek, Turkish shops and buy things and cook for the board of directors and bring the leftovers home to my father, who was a trainee accountant. So we used to eat very well, the kind of simple stuff, the sort of roast chickens and the cakes she's brilliant at, pies, all that sort of stuff. So we used to eat very, very well. What she's not so good at is anything kind of east of Vienna. So, you know, sort of curries and pilafs and anything spicy, she can't do really, because she doesn't really enjoy spicy food. So I'm not sure about my earliest memory, but we did eat pretty well.
And did you learn to cook at that stage?
I didn't actually, no. Oddly enough, I think my mother used to try and get me interested, but I never cooked. And I went to university completely unable to cook. In fact, my kind of advice to anybody going to university is just, you know, learn to cook. And I used to make these horrible pasta sauces with far too many onions in. So I didn't really learn to cook until I started, till I kind of lived on my own and started trying to impress girls. So I would sort of try and cook like a big meal and stuff. And to be honest, I was pretty terrible. So I think it's only since I got married 10, 11 years ago that I've become competent in the kitchen.
And have you always been interested in food and wine? Were you an adventurous child? I mean, wine's a bit adventurous for a child, but you know what I mean. Or were you fussy? Did you turn your nose up at things?
I was quite a good cook. There's two things I couldn't eat. Well, five. Anything kind of like tapioca. So tapioca, rice pudding, semolina, just if that turned up at school, my stomach used to turn. I went to quite an old fashioned school where you'd sit there until you finished it, and I would not finish it. So I used to sit there for hours while the sort of sadistic teacher would be like, eat it, boy, eat it. And baked beans. I can't stand baked beans. But apart from that, I was quite adventurous. And we used to go on holiday to Portugal every year, to the Algarve. And we would eat langoustine and clams and mussels and things like that, swordfish. So no, I was pretty adventurous compared with, say, my daughter, or my eldest daughter, who is really hard to get to eat anything apart from a ham sandwich.
And obviously, you write a lot about drink. What, I mean, do you remember when you had your first drink? How old were you?
My parents were very relaxed about alcohol. It makes them sound like they were alcoholics or something, but they were giving me kind of light beer at 12. We were allowed wine at 13, 14. I think I first tried champagne when I was about 10. That was probably the first thing I ever had. My mother let me have some champagne. I thought it tasted revolting. So that was probably the first alcoholic drink I had, about 10, having some champagne, and I didn't like it.
Were you a boarder when you were at school?
Well, I wasn't. I went to this prep school, and actually, in retrospect, the food was really good for school food. In fact, my favourite thing was really old-fashioned liver and onions. You know, where they kind of do the liver in like a thick gravy, and the liver's like, it's almost a bit like a sole of a shoe. I used to love it. So the food was actually pretty good. It was all homemade by, you know, kind of ladies with big arms, old-fashioned dinner ladies. And it was good. And then I went to boarding school when I was 13, and the food was pretty terrible. It all had like a... I think it was all made centrally or came from outside caterers and then reheated centrally. Thick layer of oil floating on the top of everything. And I became very unhealthy, and I just used to live on crisp sandwiches because the food was so bad. And yeah, and I remember talking to this Russian chap I met when I was at university, and he kind of couldn't understand. He was like, so you go to these boarding schools and your parents pay all this money and the food is terrible. I'd be like, yeah. And he'd go, well, why wouldn't the food be wonderful? And just be like, well, because that's not the point. The point is the food's terrible. I don't know. Perhaps it's part of a sort of, you know, just turning you into a man or something. But it was, yeah, it was bad.
And how about once you got to university?
Again, I was very, very unhealthy. I used to eat a lot of kind of fried chicken, kebabs, pizzas, all that sort of stuff. In fact, I went to university in Leeds, and I don't know if you sort of know what Yorkshire's like for fish and chips, but they take it very, very seriously. And they do it in beef dripping, and the haddock is always, it's always haddock, and it's always like really good quality. And there were three very good fish and chip shops within about 2 minutes walk of my house, and I used to have fish and chips twice a week. So I kind of became quite portly when I was a student, just because the fish and chips were so good. And I just, yeah, so I was very, very unhealthy as a student. I just used to drink a lot of beer, eat a lot of fish and chips, hardly do any exercise. So it was not, yeah, it was not good.
And tell us about how you ended up in the wine industry.
Well, it was because I graduated and I did English and classics, and I hadn't got a clue what to do. And I was spending quite a lot of time in Oddbins. There was an Oddbins in Headingley in Leeds. And I kind of was going to get talking to the staff, and they just seemed to be having a lot of fun. So I thought, I'm going to get a job here. So I worked for Oddbins in Leeds for about a year. And it was so much fun. We used to work very long hours and the pay was terrible. And we used to try all the wine. We used to supply all the bars with wine. So in the evenings, you'd go out and it would be like that bit in Goodfellas, you know, where there's a huge queue for the Copacabana. It was like that, the huge queue for the trendiest bar in Leeds. And they'd be like, oh, Henry, you know, come in, come to the front. So it was really good fun. And I wasn't making much money, but it wasn't, you know, quite, it was a really cheap city in the late 90s. I was living really, really cheaply and having a lot of fun. And then I thought, I'm going to make a career out of this. So I moved down to London and became assistant manager of Oddbins on Portobello Road. And it was nowhere near as fun, because being poor in London is horrible. And I used to work 14-hour days. The delivery would arrive at 8 in the morning and you'd work till 10 o'clock at night. And it was kind of sad. And I don't know if you kind of know anything about Oddbins, but it was this sort of company which was, they used to employ lots of kind of fun people, but at the same time, they used to employ a lot of people who were very clever, but sort of unambitious. You find people like that at Waterstones as well, and they've got this air of kind of thwarted ambition about them. And there were a lot of people like that at Oddbins. So it was just, in Leeds, it was fun. In London, it was less fun, and the company was going through one of its sort of periodic crises. So I kind of did that for another year and then thought, this isn't for me. So I worked in publishing for nearly 15 years, but always kept up the wine thing, was always interested in wine. And then about 2010, I thought to myself, you know, I've got all this interest in wine and I've got really nobody to share it with. So I started a blog called Henry's World of Booze.
It's a great, great name.
Yeah, it was. Do you know, some people think it's a terrible name. I have all these Americans who write to me just going, I hate the name of your blog. Because I think booze...
Really?
I think booze in the States has less jocular connotations. I think it's like winos on the streets. In fact, Jancis Robinson, you know, the kind of world's greatest wine writer, used to take me aside and say she hated the name of my blog. But I liked it, so that was the main thing. Ooh. And I started this blog, And it was like the kind of heyday of blogging, the sort of, it was before Twitter had really taken off. So people were still writing 1,000 words, putting it on their blog, and you'd get loads of comments and people discussing it. And it was, you know, it was a really, it was a fun time. So I started that, and I was trying to write amusingly about wine, mainly wine. Because I used to read restaurant critics, you know, like kind of A.A. Gill and Giles Corran. And then, you know, a lot of the time they never even mentioned the food. And I thought, why is no one doing that with wine? So I was trying to do that with wine. It became quite successful.
And was that the first time you'd sort of deliberately written something? Or have you always been one of those people scribbling away throughout your life?
I used to write a lot as a child, and I used to enter poetry competitions, you know, those kind of Cadbury's poetry competitions. And I was always given like a special commendation, but I never won anything. And then I kind of stopped writing for pleasure, probably when I got to university. And I remember I went out for lunch with this chap. I don't know if you know, he used to write for The Telegraph, and he was the deputy literary editor. He was called Toby Clements. So he used to work with Sam Leith on the books desk. We went out for lunch, and I worked in PR. So my job was to try and persuade someone like him to review books. And I was pretty terrible at it. And Toby said, "You're not very good at this kind of PR thing, but you are really opinionated about books. So why don't you review some books for us?" So I started reviewing books under a pseudonym of Henry Castiglione, because conflict of interest and stuff. Castiglione is my mother's maiden name. And it kind of went on from there. And I used to do lots of, a little bit of journalism under my pseudonym, plus my day job. And then I kind of thought it's silly writing under a pseudonym. So I kind of came out as a writer in about 2010.
But it wasn't your only pseudonym, is that right? There was also a breakfast pseudonym.
Yeah, there was a breakfast pseudonym that was called Blake Pudding. So I used to write for the London Review of Breakfast. So we used to write under names like Malcolm Eggs or Ed Benedict or Armand Croissant and things like that. And then I wrote something for the New Statesman under the pseudonym Dolores Montenegro, I think. I think that was it.
Do you find, if you're writing under a pseudonym, you can sort of be a bit more honest? Or do you not have a problem being honest under your own name?
I do. I have a real problem being honest. And, I mean, not like I'm a deceitful person, but I don't want to upset people. And I think the best stuff I've ever written was under my pseudonym, Blake Pudding. And I kind of adopted this slightly kind of louche, Michael Winner-esque alter ego of this person who went out for these breakfasts and kind of dropped names of people that no one's ever heard of. And it was so much fun. And I'd love to do it again. I'd love to write under a pseudonym and just kind of, you know, just invent a sort of alter ego and just be kind of unpleasant and silly and funny, hopefully.
So are you a big fan of breakfast? If you were doing reviews of breakfast, I imagine you must have been.
To an extent. Though, funnily enough, once I stopped writing about breakfast, I sort of went for a stage of actually not eating breakfast at all and just having a cup of coffee in the morning. But no, I do love a good breakfast.
What to you is a good breakfast? What qualifies?
I really like scrambled eggs with chilies in. So it's a dish that I think my wife, who is Californian, introduced me to. And I called it huevos fantasticos. So it's just quite spicy chilies fried with butter, and then scrambled eggs on toast, perhaps with chorizo or something like that mixed in. I think that's my favourite breakfast.
Tell us about the new book. So your new book is The Cocktail Dictionary. Presumably lockdown's been quite a good time for making cocktails. Have you been making lots of cocktails at home?
Yes. No, I've been having an awful lot of cocktails. The thing is, as my wife's been pregnant, I've been pretty much drinking on my own. So, you know, which is quite dangerous. But I've also been experimenting now. So I've got to the stage with my cocktails where I wouldn't say I've mastered the basics, but, you know, I can knock up a pretty decent Manhattan. So the new thing I've been experimenting with is sherry in cocktails. So I've been making these really nice martinis where you make them very weak. So 3 parts gin, 1 part Palo Cortado sherry, which is a kind of very rich but dry sherry, and then a tiny bit of vermouth, like a spoonful, and then stir that with ice and, you know, pour it into a glass. And that is absolutely delicious and slightly less strong than a normal martini. So you can have, you know, maybe more of them.
Over the time that you've been writing about wine and cocktails, have you seen an attitude from the general public change towards the way in which we engage with that side of dining?
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, I was sort of saying that the gin boom was over in 2015 because it couldn't, you know, they couldn't get any more gin brands, and it had barely started then. So people, I think, are now, I think the gin thing has led it, but people are now more interested in what they drink. And you see it in kind of cocktail bars. Like the other day I was in, well, I say the other day, it was probably about a year ago now, I was in Preston catching a train to do a literary festival. And I just had a bit of time, so I walked around, and there was the swankiest cocktail bar you've ever seen. It was like something that, you know, if you saw it in Soho, you'd be like, wow, this is pretty swanky for Soho. And it was in Preston, and I think you're seeing that all over the place. So people are a lot more interested. I think, anyway, it's the same with food, is, you know, you probably know more than me, but people are a lot more interested in what they're pouring down their necks than they were even 5 years ago.
And do you think that's come at the expense of wine? Do you think people are sort of focusing more on cocktails and less on wine, or is wine just as popular as ever?
No, I think people probably are drinking less wine, and I think if you look at the figures, people are actually drinking less wine. I think the sales of wine are pretty flat, whereas things like gin and rum and stuff are taking off. And you probably notice it when you go to people's houses, whereas before it was always red or white. Whereas now people are like, oh, I've got this new gin, or oh, I thought I'd make this or make that. But I think it's a return to, it's kind of a return to how things used to be, because my parents' generation, they all had their whiskey and sodas, brandy and sodas, gin and tonics and things like that. I remember Christmases at my parents' house. I mean, before I used to drink, all the old relatives would come over, my granny and grandpa, and everyone would have their own drink that was made, you know, exactly how they wanted it, a kind of whiskey and soda or a, you know, martini and tonic or something like that. So I think it's, in some ways, it's a return to sort of pre-wine boom drinking.
And what about the recent boom in non-alcoholic spirit style drinks, and you know, why it happens in beer and wine as well, that we've seen this huge increase in quite high-end non-alcoholic booze. Is it something you're interested in? Do you think the quality's good? Do you drink it yourself?
There is some good, so those non-alcoholic spirits, there are some nice ones. There are some that I just don't understand and just strike me as pure emperor's new clothes, and some of the pricing I just think is, you know, indecent. The fact that you're paying as much as a real bottle of gin, but there's no tax, there's no, you know, there's no duty or anything like that on them. So there are a few brands that I think are really good, and you mix them with tonic and it almost tastes like a gin and tonic. There are some that I'm not so keen on, but I think what's more interesting than those are things like shrubs and syrups and things like that, which I think are genuinely quite interesting. And you can, I mean, they do tend to contain sort of sugar and stuff, so they're perhaps not as good for you. But since my wife's, as I mentioned before, has been pregnant, so we've been experimenting with non-alcoholic cocktails. So you take a kind of a syrup and you add fruit juice or something, and then you might put some bitters in, you know, which are alcoholic, but you just put, you know, some drops in, and you can make some really delicious cocktails. I hate the word mocktail, it's just embarrassing.
It feels quite infantilizing, mocktail, doesn't it?
It is a bit, isn't it? You know, it's a bit, all those portmanteau words, stoptober, you know, veganuary. But so, yes, I'm not against non-alcoholic cocktails, and I think you can make really delicious ones.
Just going back to your previous book, The Empire of Booze, which also has got booze in the title, which I love. One of the things you talk about in it is that it was actually Britain rather than France that had the greatest influence on the development of wine and drink. Why do you think people sort of tend to think that France is so prominent, and perhaps think Britain is not quite as sort of sophisticated when it comes to drinking?
Well, France is obviously tremendously influential, and I was being slightly kind of counterintuitive. I mean, the whole kind of point of the book is it sort of engages you with its counterintuitive thesis. So there's no denying that France is incredibly influential, you know, Bordeaux, Burgundy, Cognac, all that kind of stuff. But my point was that the market was always the English. So most of this stuff, kind of Cognac, Bordeaux, Champagne, was going to England and was created for the English market. And the English didn't just do that. So it wasn't really kind of English people creating booze. It was more like English people demanding booze and then other people creating it. So, you know, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the, you know, rum, the Scottish with whiskey. So the whiskey's very interesting because it was considered something that was much too challenging for the English palate. And then there was a cognac shortage due to phylloxera. So these kind of canny Scots invented blended whiskey, which was a deliberately, I wouldn't say bland, but easygoing style of whiskey, specifically for English palates that were raised on cognac. So it was sort of, the English influence is more about having like a big wallet and just being like, what have you got?
Henry, do you have a favourite comfort food? Something that you might not prepare yourself, but you can do, but that just is something you'd have when you're at home, maybe alone?
Oh, gosh. Food that I'd have alone. I mean, things like cheese on toast are, you know, I love. I mean, if I'm on my own, I don't really cook, so I just live on things like cheese on toast and stuff. But I think my favourite comfort meal is my mother's apple and bramble pie. So we used to go kind of foraging for brambles, and then we had my parents' house, they have a Bramley apple tree in the garden, and she makes a pie with that. And that's my kind of, you know, that's my kind of safe place.
Wait, with cream, custard, ice cream? What's your preference?
Maybe with cream, if there is some, but I'm quite, or yogurt, but I'm quite happy having it on its own. The only thing is, though, I hope my mum's not listening, but my mother's a very good cook, but she slightly lost interest in food. So what she does is she tries to make everything convenient. So she'll get all the apples and she'll just put them all in one vat and turn them into a puree and freeze that. So when I request the pie, she'll get the puree out. And it's now, the pie's now got this kind of layer of baby food in there. So actually, my wife makes a better apple and bramble.
you are playing with fire.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to tell you this kind of story about the time that I kind of played with fire. I got in real trouble with my mother because I had my mother's actually half Italian, but she has no kind of Italian influence, so she makes very Anglo-Italian food. And when I was 8, I became friends with this boy called James Leveson, and his mother was a real Italian. She was called Fosca Leveson. She was married to an Englishman. And she used to make her own pasta. She used to make her own sauce. And I remember the first time I tried her food, it was like, it was just this huge kind of awakening. Like, wow, this is what Italian food is supposed to taste like. And I think I was only friends with James because his mother was such a wonderful cook. And then one day my mother did the spaghetti bolognese and she said, you know, how is it? And I said, it's not as good as Mrs. Leveson's. And she would just, you know, she basically was like, get out. And I've never seen her more angry than that. It was just, you never say it to your mother that it's not as good as someone else's mother's.
We won't tell her what you just said about the pie. And we wouldn't normally ask this, but I suppose we probably should. Do you have a comfort drink? Is there a drink that you turn to, you know, when you need something a bit comforting?
Do you know, I love, and this is the thing I've missed most during lockdown, is I love real ale. I love like old fashioned bitter. The thing that I crave when this is just so parochial, it's going to make me sound like such a sort of little Englander, but when I'm abroad, I always just love coming home and having like a pint of Adnams or Timothy Taylor's Landlord or something like that. And I haven't had a pint of English beer, like proper beer, for months. And I really, really miss it.
We normally, Henry, ask what a person's desert island meal or dish is. I'm going to ask you what your desert island drink is.
Oh, well, it would have to be like a huge butt of sherry. So it would be, a butt is the, it's not something rude. It's a English corruption of the word butter. And it's a 500 litre cask of sherry. And it would have to be an everlasting 500 litre cask of sherry. And it would be like a Manzanilla or something. So a kind of very dry sherry from Sanlúcar. That's the one drink I can never get sick of. So that would be my desert island drink.
Henry, thank you so much for joining Table Talk. And Henry's new book, or his latest book, rather, The Cocktail Dictionary, is out now.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to The Spectator website.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.